This program is live and local. It's your connection to local performances. Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Kelly. Thanks for joining us today. On our program today, coming up, we will be talking with and hearing some singing from cast members of a play, a musical play called Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson, which tells the story of our seventh president in a quite different way than one might expect, unless you happen to know something about the show. This is being put on by the Celebration Company at the Station Theater in Urbana. It opened last week and continues through February 2nd. Live preview coming up on the show today. First, I'll be talking with two members of the Cleveland Quartet, award-winning Jasper String Quartet, with participation in the Cleveland Quartet Awards by the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, and they will be presenting the Jaspers on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock in their Folinger Auditorium. That is in Urbana. We'll be hearing some performances from them and conversation as well. Here is the first of those performances, music by Franz Joseph Haydn. We just heard some music by Franz Joseph Haydn, some of the first movement of his string quartet, Opus 76, Number 1. And that's played by the Jasper String Quartet, who are going to be at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock as the 2012 winners of the Cleveland Quartet Award. They're going to open their program with a different, slightly later a quartet by Haydn, along with music by Aaron J. Kernis and Ludwig von Beethoven. I have on the phone with me right now two members of the Jasper String Quartet, their second violinist, Sai Chonobayashi, and the viola, Sam Quintal. Thank you both very much for joining us on the show.
Our pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Well, the first thing I really need to ask you is about the connection that you all have with the string quartet in residence that is at the University of Illinois, the Jupiter String Quartet, because I looked at the names of your members and I saw two people with the last name of Freifogel, and there happened to be two people in the Jupiter String Quartet with the last name of Freifogel, and my question is there indeed that a connection?
Yes, indeed. There's a lovely connection. Actually, our first violinist, Jay Freifogel, he's the youngest of four siblings of his family, and he's two older sisters in the Jupiter Quartet who plays in second and viola. And actually, they're both married to the cellist, both Jupiter's second violinist married to the cellist in the Jupiter Quartet, and then Jay's married to our cellist, Rachel.
That's
we have
right.
a really nice connection.
Yeah. And so did you all, I'm actually forgetting, were they they had met, and wasn't it also at Oberlin Conservatory, as you guys did?
Actually, their violist, Liz, went to Oberlin Conservatory. Three of us, Jay, Rachel, and I, all went to Oberlin, so we have that nice connection, too. And actually, this past fall, we played a program with the Jupiters playing the Mendelssohn Octet, which was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I would imagine that's always a wonderful experience when you combine a couple of ensembles for that piece, which is fantastic anyway. And as long as we're talking about names of people, the name of your quartet has an interesting derivation for a quartet, I think. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, we're named after the national park in Canada, Jasper National Park, which is a really gorgeous place, but I think not all of us have actually been there. We really just like the name, and we all agreed that it was a nice name, and Jay was happy that it started with a J, and we've been happy with it ever since.
And how did Jay Freifogel, Jay, by the way, is just an initial, the letter J. Does he actually have a first name?
He does actually have a first name. It's John, but his whole life's been Jay, just
Jay,
the letter.
That's it, okay. Well, we've cleared up all the names, I think. And now let's talk a little bit about the award, which is something that the Krannert Center is actually involved in, as I understand it. The Cleveland Quartet retired in 1995 and got together with Chamber Music America and eight other chamber music presenters, including the Krannert Center, to create this particular award. And what was involved for you all to end up winning it?
Well, I first would just like to say that I think it's an incredibly great award in the way that it was set up, in the foresight with which it was set up, and in the way that it was put together, that the prize is basically concerts, because that's exactly what an ensemble in our position needs more of, is these great concerts. And we're so honored and excited to be able to play at the Krannert Center and the seven other concerts of the series that supported the establishment of the award. The other amazing thing about the award is that we didn't really have to do anything. It's nominated by members of CMA. There's a panel of people who came to some of our concerts without our knowledge, and then there's a panel that decides who receives the award. So we didn't have to go through the stress of a competition and apply for anything. It's decided by CMA, and they call us up one day and said we had won, and that was, I think, one of the best days of our quartet life. So it was pretty amazing.
I think
and we're really, really honored to be selected for it.
Yeah, congratulations. You said that this is really useful, performances are really useful to an ensemble in our position. How would you describe your position at this point in your career?
I mean, we've been together in our current formation for 5 years. So in the sort of age of string quartets, we're still pretty young as a string quartet. And we're, trying to build up the level of concerts that we're playing, the number of concerts that we're playing, obviously, too. So it's really to sort of spread out the places that we play, places that we didn't necessarily have connections before, to meet people there and get connections, and also just to get to play in these really great series that, haven't necessarily been able to afford having us because we didn't have that sort of establishment that this award kind of helped us with.
One of the things that you have made a point of doing in your short career as a quartet is playing some newer music and doing some commissioning. The second piece that's on the program is by a contemporary composer, Aaron J. Kernis, his string quartet number 2. Is this a piece that you had any hand in commissioning, or is it one that you've existed and you picked up?
Yeah, this is the one he composed, and we feel very fortunate to meet this encounter this piece because we four of us individually fall in love into this piece, and And ever since we've been playing his, actually our number one quartet as well, and we are hoping to commission his third one. We are working on that right now.
There's a note in the program for this concert that Mr. Kernis actually says that he turned to composers like Bach, Beethoven, and other earlier composers for inspiration for this particular quartet. Before we hear a little bit of the opening movement, which is called an overture, can you describe a little bit how that might show, how that influence shows up in this music?
Yeah, the first movement is actually a dance suite, much like the Bach cello suites. He took the idea of these six dances put together, and he actually combined them all into one movement. And it's a really wonderful thing because it sort of shows the variety of his musical style and his expression. And actually, more specifically to this program, the last movement of this quartet is very closely based in form on the last movement of the Beethoven Quartet, Opus 59, Number 3, which is a really neat connection, and we're really excited to get to play both of those pieces on this program so you can see how those fit together.
Well, let's give a listen to some of the overture, the beginning movement of Aaron Kernis's String Quartet Number 2. It's played here by the Jasper String Quartet, who will play it in its entirety, of course, Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Kraner Center for the Performing Arts. And we're talking with two of the members of the quartet, second violinist Sai Chonobayashi and violist Sam Quintal, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. That's some music by Aaron J. Kernis from his second string quartet, the first movement, and played here by the Jasper String Quartet, who will be playing it at the Kranich Center in Urbana Sunday afternoon, along with a quartet by Haydn and one by Beethoven, one of his quartets known as the Razumovsky Quartet for the person for whom it was written. I have with me on the phone Sam Quintal, violist of the Jasper Quartet, and violinist Sai Chonobayashi. The Cleveland Quartet, talking about the longevity of quartets, you've been around 6 years in the present formation. They were 26 years, and Juilliard's, I imagine, quite a bit longer than that. How much do you, as a quartet, listen to recordings of other quartets and perhaps decide, oh, I like the way this quartet plays this piece, or I don't like the way they play this piece, or I don't like their sound. This is something we want to copy. It's not something we want to copy. How does that figure in your own preparation for your own performances, if at all?
I mean, we're lucky to be in a line of work where we have this incredibly rich tradition. These great quartets. We actually studied with some of the members of the Cleveland Quartet. We studied at Yale with the Tokyo Quartet. And that tradition is really where we draw our roots from. I mean, and so we have spent a lot of time listening to their recordings, listening to their concerts. I actually just went to the Tokyo Quartet's last concert at Yale. They're just ending this summer. It's kind of an amazing and slightly bittersweet experience for everyone. But yes, we take incredible inspiration from all quartets. We enjoy listening to other young quartets too. We feel really lucky to be part of this tradition.
Before we hear some of the Beethoven in one of your performances, talk just briefly about some of your approach to outreach that you have made a habit of doing, I understand, in schools, and you've done this thing called guerrilla chamber music up in Canada, where you were in residence for a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really, really enjoy playing in schools for kids. We do a lot of playing also in retirement homes in Philadelphia through Astral Artists. They've been really helpful to us, both in helping us schedule more outreach things and also in sort of instructing us on what works and what doesn't work and helping us figure out better ways to do things. So we really enjoy bringing music to people who, especially kids who have a very honest and immediate reaction to the music. It's really inspiring, and it inspires us to think about the music in a very different way. If you're playing a Haydn movement for a bunch of kindergartners, to think about something in that music that really grabs their attention is completely different from the sort of subtlety of shading that we're usually trying to work on. And it really helps, actually, to be able to describe something to someone who's very fresh to it. In a way that gives them something to get excited about.
Well, let's say you're playing in front of a bunch of kindergartners and you've got a Haydn movement. Will you just play it straight the way you would in a concert, or would you do something different with it? Do you fragment it? How would you present it to kids that young?
I mean, the specific Haydn movement that we always come back to is which chord, 76 number one, I think. It's a minuet, and it's got this sequence of surprises in it, dynamic surprises. It starts off very soft, and there's a sudden fortissimo, and then it goes back to very soft again, and he's constantly playing with the timing of when the fortissimo part is going to come, so it surprises you. And we describe this as peekaboo, as, you know, surprising the kids. And it's more effective than we ever would have imagined. We played it for a group of, like, 80 kindergartners, and you couldn't hear the soft sections after the loud because all of them are screaming too loudly. It was kind of amazing.
Well, I guess you get at them early however you can, right?
Yeah.
And some of them may end up in some
to even junior high and high school.
Say that again? Say that again?
It even works to junior high school and high school kids sometimes.
The same movement.
Yeah.
Well, very good. Well, let's listen to the Jasper String Quartet. This is the final movement of the piece that will close their program on Sunday afternoon, which is Beethoven's Quartet Number 9, known as the Razumovsky Quartet. The Jasper String Quartet won the Cleveland Quartet Award in 2012, and that's bringing them to the Kranitz Center Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock in Urbana. And my guests have been second violinist Sai Chonobayashi and violist Sam Quintal. Thank you very much for joining us. Happy travels, and have a great concert on Sunday.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a
pleasure. Opening portion of the final movement of Beethoven's String Quartet Number 9, his Opus 59 Number 3, nicknamed the Razumovsky Quartet, played by the Jupiter String Quartet, who will play the entire piece and two others on their concert Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Kranitz Center in Urbana. Mike Pritchard just corrected me. I meant to say the Jasper String Quartet. Thank you very much, Mike. Not the Jupiter. Jasper String Quartet. Our broadcast today is made possible with support from Sweeney Brothers Carpet and Rug Gallery of Bloomington, a Neurison preferred dealer at 11 Westport Court on Bloomington's east side. Sweeney Brother, where the beauty of a room starts with the floor.
Our next feature is on a show that actually opened last week at the Station Theater in Urbana. The Celebration Company there is presenting a 2011 musical called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, music and lyrics by Michael Friedman. The book is by Alex Timbers. It's being directed by Michael Matthews Jr., musical direction by David Barkley, and featuring quite a number of people, including the folks who are with us on the program today, to do a little bit of a live preview. Preview, of course, for those who haven't seen it. What do you call it? A post-view for those who have seen it? The show is running through February 2nd, including tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday at 8 o'clock. And then you can check their website for the complete schedule. Michael Matthews, director.
Yes.
Why this show?
We were kind of looking around for something to do, and Matthew Green and I had sort of fallen in love with the music for this, and so when we're looking for something that might be good, we came upon that, and actually we actually agreed to do it before anyone had actually read the script, which is rare. Thankfully, the music was so clever.
Including yourself?
Oh, yeah. We actually were talking about it during Rent one time. Like, you know, none of us have actually read the script. Like, hope it's good. Thankfully, the script was hysterically funny when we got it. As clever as the music was, I didn't think there was any real danger that the script would falter.
So is this music, I mean, you said fell in love with the music. Is this music you really fall in love with?
Yeah, well, because it's clever, it's fun, it's, there's certain things, I mean, like a Rent or a Full Monty, you kind of fall in love with the heart of. Something like this is clearly having a great time. This is how you fall in love with, like, Evil Dead and Army of Darkness.
So you have to be somebody who falls in love with those sorts of things.
Well, if you're not that person, I don't want to know you.
You're prerogative, but you want them to come to your show. Well, it's an interesting, I mean, the title itself, you don't really know what the title suggests, except that, I can tell you that my first assumption was when I saw Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson was that it had to be somebody else named Andrew Jackson because it just didn't sound like it would be about, well, I guess he was our seventh president. And lo and behold, it is, I guess, sort of, or is it, well, is it really?
Well, the thing is, Jackson, well, not a rock star in the sort of sense that he is in the show, he would do things like bring prostitutes to City Hall meetings back before he was president. He would do things that you would expect a petulant rock star to do. He often offended people by his sort of brazen attitudes. And I think they just kind of captured that in this emo rock, semi-punk sensibility that really is fun.
And you really, it's one of those conceits where you really wonder who came up with that idea.
I would like to befriend those people. I would go out with them and hang out and just be like, we're going to have a good time.
And Andrew Jackson, the emo version, played by Corbin Dixon, who's actually been on this show at least a couple of times, if not several before, for things at the Station Theater, for things for the Champaign-Urbana Theater Company in various roles. And I'm assuming because I saw, I think, in a newspaper article that you actually have a job now, that means you've finished your program at the university?
Yeah, I did finish last spring. So I've been working since 2011 for Planned Parenthood. I'm the manager of education. And then I just continue to do performing in the area and kind of sing when there's opportunities.
And you were in the fledgling musical theater program, but I guess you actually have to major in something else.
Well, it's an open studies program, so you get your degree in music, but then you kind of design your coursework around similar music theater programs, but you get a little bit more flexibility in terms of what you want to focus in. So specific to acting classes or movement classes, what you really feel like you need to work on or that you could really excel at, you get a little bit of some flexibility in terms of picking those courses.
And what have any of those courses or that program done to prepare you for this particular role?
Well, you know, the Open Studies program through the U of I, it's very much a voice program with a focus in acting and dance versus foreign language and diction. So it's very similar to the voice program. So with that, however, this is a really, you know, I like to think of it very much like a play. And I always was kind of that person that hated when people would say, oh, you're in that play, Les Mis, or you're in that play, Aida. But, you know, I want to be like, oh, it's a musical. But this is very much one of the first shows or musicals I've been in that I don't get so frustrated with because it is really very much a play. So that acting training and that movement training, I think, was really beneficial for taking on this character since that was such an important part of this process.
And how does this character compare, if that's even the right word, to some of the others that I know you've played?
Well,
or is it? I'm actually assuming that it's unlike any other character you've played.
It is a very different character. I think that, you know, in the past I played a lot of romantic leads or opposites, and this very much is about himself. He's very arrogant, doesn't really need anybody else's permission or approval, and very self-focused. So I think that that character is quite different to see and portray versus some of the other ones. So I really appreciated the challenge to kind of do that and stretch that a little bit versus what I've had the chance to do in the past.
So do you have to really discover some other character that doesn't belong to you, or do you have to dig deep and find somewhere in Corbin Dixon there is this character?
Well, I think that that's something that you have to do with any role. You have to find ways to personalize it. And even Andrew Jackson, you know, no bad guy or character that's portrayed as bad thinks that they're a bad guy. So it's just finding out, actually, you know, maybe I have this in me that I can relate and maximize to this huge potential, but, you know, I'm taking it somewhere from within my own character and trying to relate that the best way possible.
Well, here's what Musical Theater International thinks of this character. He's a roguish man's president who is deeply charming and sexy, yet is also an extremely violent, arrogant, bigoted idiot that fights for what he believes in. You've probably read that yourself,
yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's what you're in for if you go to see this show. Corbin Dixon in the role of Andrew Jackson, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, that the Station Theater is putting on. And we have at the microphone David Butler, who, according to the station website, is playing band leader, etc.
Yes.
Which means what?
Well, it was going to be just the band leader, which is an actual named character in the show. He has some lines, and he kind of leads the small ensemble. But then we had a couple people who had to drop out of the show, and Michael said, "Would you be interested in playing these other characters that other people were going to play?" And I said, "Well, if you don't mind me kind of taking the guitar off, putting the guitar on, taking the guitar, you know, every 5 minutes or so." He said, "That's fine."
Probably adds for some comedy, perhaps, to adds additional comedy.
So I hope not unintentional. Yeah.
So you're geared up with the guitar. Are you doing the first song, or are we doing something else?
It'll be all of us.
All of us. And what's the song, and how does it figure in the show? Set us up a little bit. Somebody.
So that guy?
Yeah.
At this point, Andrew Jackson has decided it is time to take upon the mantle to be president of the United States eventually. And he comes out to a large rock star beginning, and yeah.
So it's essentially at the beginning of the musical, or close.
Hmm? It's pretty early on.
He's a reluctant populist leader, but now he's decided to get over his reluctance.
Because he's just that awesome.
Yes.
In his own opinion.
Right.
Ready?
Sometimes you have to take the initiative.
Sometimes your whole family dies of cholera.
Sometimes you have to make your own story.
Sometimes you have to shoot the storyteller in the neck.
Sometimes you have to take back the country.
Sometimes you have to kill everyone, everyone, everyone,
everyone, everyone, everyone.
I always thought I'd never be that guy, but guess what? I am telling you. I always thought I'd never be that guy, but guess what? I am telling you. I'm so that guy. I'm so that guy.
I will make them all bleed.
So that sets a tone. Is this the tone
nice
that carries? Is this the tone that carries through most of the show?
Not all the songs are that driving. And this, keep in mind, this is an approximation. It's usually done with the full band, drums, electric bass, electric keyboard, and electric guitar. So, but that was the basic energy though. Was definitely there.
And full cast, I imagine.
Yeah.
Full cast is what, about 20 people, looks
13.
Like something like
13 people.
Okay, I'll
it
recount.
It seems like 20. It's
actually the only person that plays a single role really is Corbin. Everyone else doubles up, plays several other parts throughout.
Is that what's asked for in the script?
Yeah, they actually suggest, they say about 13 is their minimum and actually what they suggest because it allows them the actors to be constantly switching. You guys don't get a lot of downtime during the show. That it's an hour and a half
which
where
like,
they have to be at really, really high energy and ready to go at all the time.
Is that a new trend in musicals or maybe not so new? And the reason I ask is that it seems like this is about the fourth show in the last year and a half maybe where exactly that happens, where not very many actors play a whole lot of characters.
Well, and like the 39 steps that I did, that was more because of the humor of the characters were like the two of us switching into 17 different roles. Here, my guess is with the musicals, partly is financial, because I don't think Broadway is getting quite as many people as they used to. So having these huge, like, you know, 40, 50 person casts is just not particularly possible, particularly in a lot of these smaller theaters. This was built for a much smaller theater when it was first created. And actually seemed to do better off-Broadway than it did on Broadway. So the smaller cast there probably made it more feasible.
Well, and then with these rock musicals, too, that you have, you know, if you're singing these rock songs, you don't need 50, 80 people, that you can have a smaller ensemble, especially for spaces like Station Theater or spaces off-Broadway. If you have, you know, much more than these 13, 15 kind of people that it asks for, I think it's a little overpowering to some extent with the band and then all the, you know, people yelling and screaming these songs. I think it could be a little much.
Yelling and screaming the song. Yeah,
our ensemble puts out an amazing amount of power when they're all out there singing. It's a little much sometimes.
Well, and when you're in a small space like the station, it's going to carry to everybody, almost no matter how many people are there. This show was largely a critical success. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the critics seemed to like it, but not many people showed up for it, and it didn't last on Broadway very long.
Yeah, it did. Off Broadway seemed to be doing fairly well when it moved to Broadway, and I don't know exactly why, but there it underperformed. But it's a terrifically fun show.
Well, I was going to ask if you had any sense of that, but I guess not. You just headed that one off. What about I'm guessing it'd be the sort of show that the community theater would enjoy putting on.
Yeah, there's a lot of nice things about it, but partly one of the concerns we had when we first did it was finding the cast, because the regular station theater actors tend to skew a little bit older, and we were really hoping.
Thanks.
But awesome. But awesome. They tend to skew a little bit older, and this is a much sort of younger show. Luckily, we were during a time when we had a lot of U of I students who were available to audition, and about half of the people in the show are U of I students, and the other half were in Rent.
Or both.
So we've got besides David Butler, we have five actors with us. I should introduce everybody. Corbin Dixon, we've heard from, and David Butler. Stephanie Senior is playing, and another, well, just about everybody plays Et Cetera. So tour guide Et Cetera is what it says for Stephanie, and Jay Kim, Black Fox, Et Cetera. An actual named character, and Mark Fox, no relation to Black Fox, plays President Clay. No other characters.
I do, actually.
You do have some.
Yes.
Okay, well, more on that coming up, and Laura Welly, 10 Little Indian Soloist, Et Cetera.
Et Cetera.
Et Cetera. Henry Clay is in it. He was a prominent political figure in Andrew Jackson's day. There are some other prominent political figures named who had been president. President Monroe, Martin Van Buren, I forget the order of things, so maybe some of them became president, John Quincy Adams. How much is this actually a history lesson?
I wouldn't substitute this for the reading of the textbook.
But some of it's true. I mean, almost all of it's true.
Yeah, there's plenty of truth there, but they're going to have a very skewed idea of who, say, Clay was, for example. It does bring up some of the battles. He was a murder machine in battle. He would kill thousands of the enemy, and this was British, Spanish, Native Americans, and lose like 24 guys. I think the Battle of New Orleans, I think he actually lost like 24 guys and killed several thousand of the enemy. The battle is such a reel. The idea that there was a bargain that was made to make him, to basically keep Andrew Jackson from becoming president. And those are in there. Those are used, there's truth in the mill of the funny. that's used throughout the show?
Well, since you mentioned Henry Clay, now I said President Clay, which is how he's billed there. Henry Clay was never president.
He never was. No, I think that might just be an inside joke by them.
That was an error. There are 115 different roles I had to put. I screwed up.
That's a sheer error. Okay.
He's in among the founding fathers during the show. So when I was listing them off, I accidentally put president.
There we go.
Okay. He wanted to be president, though.
So what's the skewed depiction of Henry Clay?
Well, the reality of Henry Clay is he was actually a very prominent politician in his day. He was known as the Great Compromiser. He did a lot of great things. He was actually the first person to be laid in state at the Capitol building when he died. And he was well known. He had a bit of an attitude, but he was probably bitter he never became the president after trying 3-4 times.
He did research. Wow.
But but in the show, he is basically just a caricature of evil, and he's just a sniveling little just terrible person.
Who always carries a pet weasel.
Mark is the only person not dressed up as an iconic rock star in the show, but he's dressed as Crispin Glover in some of his more crazy periods.
Which is probably close enough. Well, I mean, you sort of laughingly said, oh, you did some research, and I wondered how much research is it good to do, or was it? Did you find good to do for the particular characters, since they are real people, some of them?
For Clay, I'd say,
or is it pointless?
Did a disservice to what the show wants Clay to be. So, because I was like, well, he wasn't that bad of a guy, actually. But I don't know. It's still
knowing the context helped get a lot of the darker moments out, because this is a fantastic comedy, and there's moments where even people that have seen the show as many times as the cast has, we're still laughing backstage. We can't help ourselves. But there are some distinctly unfunny, really dark moments where I feel like some audience members are... my mom said she cried at the very end. And it's...
very end of the show or of the song?
There's a pretty integral scene between Corbin's character, Andrew Jackson, and his former friend, Black Fox. And despite the fact that this is a hugely funny show, and even some lines in that particular scene are incredibly humorous for their own right, it doesn't shy away from the actual historical implications of what occurred. And because of that, yeah, I think it really hits home, especially since this audience is expecting us to bring constant humor to the situation, and all of a sudden they realize the full context.
Well, the bloody, bloody part is historically true also. I mean, particularly in relation to Indians. He had a significant role, and I don't know what it was exactly, because I haven't done my history, studied my history, in the whole Trail of Tears, which, of course, one of the worst things ever to happen to natives in our country. How do you, as actors, balance the serious implications of a lot of what you're making fun of?
I'd say the script helps. And this is one thing I particularly enjoy in the shows I direct. There is a heart of darkness at the kind of towards the end of this, where it does kind of go from the breakneck pace of someone who wanted to be president, thought it would be a lot of fun, and finds out there's a lot of really difficult things when it gets up there. And part of it includes a trail of tears. It doesn't shy away from the fact that this is a man who can be seen as like a Hitler. There's From what I've been told and a little bit of the reading I've done, there are places where Native Americans will not accept a 20 because it's got Andrew Jackson's face on it.
That you're that bad a guy, bloody bloody Andrew Jackson. But then there was also, you know, he was known as a populist president, I guess. He was sort of anti everything, elitist, and so on. So some might say he was a good guy in that sense, but I guess it's what he did with that intention.
And that's a huge...
How much research did you do?
I did quite a bit, and it was difficult because you have to balance it to the point in understanding its kind of current setting to some extent and be able to translate it kind of into this rock character. But I think by taking just who he appeared to be through history and being able to translate that into this kind of rock and roll, like, you know, Green Day or kind of like Foo Fighter frontman kind of person, and try and translate some of that that arrogance and that star kind of status, I think was actually pretty easy. It was easier than originally I thought it would be to translate that into this role, to the point where I really understood why the writers decided to do it with this approach. Because I've been in historical shows before that have never really taken on this contemporary approach, but the fact that it was written like this, throughout this process, it started to make so much more sense as we went along.
Here are some other facts about Andrew Jackson. Michael mentioned a couple others. He threw a good party, apparently. A mob gathering at the White House for the party after his inauguration. He liked birds, which is interesting. He has even his pet parrot attending his funeral.
Got kicked out of his funeral.
Is that right?
For cussing.
The parrot did?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Parrot, too many swear words.
Well, speaking of cussing, I understand there's a fair amount of it in this production.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
There is.
So, not recommended for people under...
Under 17. I've been telling everyone, if you can't see a rated R movie, don't come see this.
Maybe not. Yeah.
That's a pretty good borderline, actually.
And likewise, even though the song we heard and the songs we're about to hear sound a little tamer on here because there isn't a rock band backing them up, there is a rock band backing them up in the show.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the singing is on microphones. So it does get loud.
Does one need to, this is a personal question, does one need to bring earplugs to this?
We've been told it's loud.
I've seen a couple patrons, you know, occasionally.
Oh, really?
Plugging their ears.
Actually have the rock band is front and center on stage in like a Blues Brothers style cage.
All right. Well, that would be me with the fingers in my ears. So thank you for
the warning. I stand right in front of the drum kit and I haven't felt the need for earplugs yet, but. Maybe.
You're rock and roll.
Maybe I'm...
Dave's deaf.
Maybe my hearing's already going, so...
We're talking with cast members and the director of the current production at the Station Theater in Urbana, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. It opened last week. It continues through February 2nd, including tonight at 8 o'clock and tomorrow and Sunday. And I know we've got at least a couple more songs. What do you want to do next?
The next song we're going to do is called Public Life. And at this point in the show, Andrew Jackson's wife had just passed away. And I think it's when he really starts to realize that maybe this popular persona, this kind of rock star status, doesn't always get him necessarily what he wants. It doesn't always lead to the best thing for him. So he's kind of making that realization in the song.
So and he honors his wife by doing the last thing she wanted him to do.
Right. Yeah. By becoming president.
And she, I mean, there's a, that relationship figures into this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Significantly.
Yeah. Katarina, who plays Rachel, and I did a lot of work trying to figure out this relationship, which was really, really complex. And, you know, they loved each other very much, but it's interesting to see a man that is so egotistical, how much, even though he loved his wife, how much he was still willing to take the people first and kind of take this celebrity status over that relationship.
Corbin Dixon in the role of Andrew Jackson here on Live and Local.
So I see where two worlds divide. The public man when his wife has died. And just when everything I wanted was within my grasp, the irony, yeah, the irony is killing me. This public life, no private life. And to my wife, I make this one last vow. I'll give my life to the people now. I'll be the man they need, the one to lead a generation. I'll listen to their voice with every choice as we reform this nation. Oh, I'll keep on going. Oh, I'll keep on going. Time to be that guy. I'm gonna take this country back.
There's nothing left in this old town. Pick up your life and move it around. You got to get down to DC. Pick up your rifle and make a stand.
The change is coming now. Can you feel it? It's coming on now. It's coming on now. This is what you've been waiting for. Trail is always leading
Corbin Dixon is Andrew Jackson, and David Butler on the guitar. He's going to be, So are you actually the leader of this band? You're not the music director.
More or less. Yeah, I wasn't the music director, but I sort of, once in a while, if I remember, give cues to the rest of the band, you know.
If you remember, right.
If I
I'm sure they appreciate your efforts.
I hope so, yeah. Sometimes I, you know, get a little bit carried away and
our
count
band,
on them to...
Our band has some great rock cred, like local rock cred, too.
Yeah, basically, I've played in bands before, but most of my playing has been in musical theater. The other three guys are the opposite. They're real trained rock guys.
What are some of the bands they played in? You know offhand?
Oh, Jam and Jimmy Bean, done a lot of stuff in the area. Mike Meadows, I'm trying to remember their actual bands. I'm forgetting on the names. And Dr. Dave, who's a fantastic piano player. We've just got really...
He plays with the Stevie Hall Band.
There's a line in the description of the show on the Music Theater International website, which is who provides scripts and whatnot, that this is an actor-driven rather than design-dependent musical. What does that mean, really?
There is a bit of chaos inherent in a show like this, now, which is kind of lucky for us because we had like 13 rehearsals to put it together because a break was a problem.
And I assume that's not very many.
Oh, that's we had about half of the actual getting together and working on stuff time that I would prefer for a show like this. This is one where, or being a rock star is a cult of personality. I mean, people remember Dave Grohl now because he's in Foo Fighters, but back Nirvana was Kurt Cobain. As far as there's two other guys there, Chris something was the other guy's name.
Cornell.
No, that's Soundgarden.
Novoselic.
And then the because of that, the stuff the actors have brought. Is hugely important to the show. There's things that each of, like everyone here does that was not directed, that's come out of them, and particularly the way it's grown over the last little bit, has been fantastic. Like the show we have could not have been, I could not do this exact same show with another group of actors because they've had to bring so much into it, partly because of the nature of the show and partly because of the time.
And the design-driven element, though, like design-dependent musical, something like... oh yeah, we got somebody's
Sweet.
Phone here.
I'm guessing that.
I assume refers... something like Phantom of the Opera would be a design-driven show.
Yeah.
Well, when my choreographer Whitney, who does most of my shows, one of the things we talked about is we have a couple things that we start off with something that's kind of choreographed at the beginning to show that we can do it, but then beyond that, a lot of it is more sort of naturally what's coming out of the characters. It shouldn't look too
staged.
Yeah, I mean, it there's a spontaneous feel to this show that is important to the energy because there's way too much energy to have it be like just exact every single time.
So the relationship with the designers was really close as well. We did a lot of work with them. I think more than any show I've ever been in is working with the designers, with our prop masters, our lighting designer, and even the band. I've never before ever had that kind of relationship with a band on stage because they're a part of the show. So, you know, and I know that wouldn't fall necessarily into the area of designers, but the fact that there's usually a huge disconnect between the actor and the pit often times because they're either, you know, off stage or somewhere else that we don't get to interact a lot, but they're actually characters in the show. So that relationship is very synchronous, and I've never really experienced that before with the show.
We have time for your last song, which is...
We're going to do Hunters of Kentucky.
Hunters of Kentucky.
Which Dave's going to take out?
Which is the big rousing finale of the sort of feel good, send him home with a good feeling song.
After the darkness. Hey.
After the darkness.
From Bloody Bloody, Andrew Jackson.
Yes.
Ye gentlemen and ladies fair who grace this famous city. Just listen if you've time to spare while I rehearse a ditty. And for the opportunity, conceive yourself quite lucky, for it is not often that you see a hunter from Kentucky.
Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky.
And Jackson, he was wide awake and was not scared of trifles, for well he knew what aim to take with our Kentucky rifles.
He led them down to Cypress Swamp, the ground was low and mucky, and there stood John Bull and Pop,
and here was old Kentucky.
Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky.
We heard, as Andrew Jackson, Corbin Dixon, and as various members of the cast, David Butler, also playing guitar, Stephanie Sr., Jay Kim, Mark Fox, and Laura Welly, and heard a lot as well from the director of this show, Michael Matthews. Right?
Yes.
I'm not looking
at... You heard a lot from me, because I talked
to you. I suddenly realize I'm not looking at your name, and I'm afraid I'm mixing up with somebody else's, but good, I'm glad I didn't. I know it's spelled M-I-K-E-L, which is unusual. Mm-hmm. This is from Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which is the current production by the Station Theater at the by the Celebration Company at the Station Theater in Urbana. It runs through February 2nd, including throughout this weekend at 8 o'clock for all the shows. For more information, you can go to stationtheater.com. And get all the information you need to get tickets. Thanks all very much for coming in, and best of luck with the rest of the run.
Thank you.
Our broadcast today is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring new exhibits entitled America's Musical Past, Shenanigans, Hootenannies, and Other Twisted Adventures. More information is available at sousaarchives.com. There are... few other things, actually a great many other things that you can do in see and hear in our listening area this weekend. I'll see what I can mention. Leaving Iowa is being put on at Richland Community College, 7:30 tonight, runs through Sunday. The Illinois Chamber Orchestra is performing three times this weekend, tonight at 6 and 7:30 at First Presbyterian Church in Springfield, and tomorrow night at 7:30 at Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington. Donnie Heitler and Olivia Flanagan Duo are at Silver Creek Restaurant in Urbana this evening at 5:30. Monticello Theater Association is presenting Love, Loss, and What I Wore at the Phoenix Theater, 6 o'clock tonight and Saturday and Sunday as well. Jenny Owen Youngs and Megan Johns are at the High Dive in Champaign tonight at 7 o'clock. Community Players Theater in Bloomington presenting Lend Me a Tenor. At their own theater at 7:30 tonight and tomorrow, Sunday matinee, 2:30. And the Springfield Theater Center presents Couplings at the Hoagland Center in Springfield. That is at 8 o'clock tonight and tomorrow, Sunday matinee at 2 o'clock. Also at the Hoagland Center, the Traveling McCourys and Henhouse Prowlers play bluegrass at 8 o'clock. They have multiple venues there, so they can have various shows at the same time. Millikan University Jazz faculty are at Lock, Stock, and Barrel in Decatur tomorrow afternoon at 3:30. And also at the same location, the West End Blues Project comes in at 8 o'clock. It's Hayward Williams doing folk Americana and other sorts of music at Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Fairmount tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. The Polkaholics are at Big Grove Tavern in Champaign tomorrow night at 8:30. Strings Attached, Big Blue Stem String Band in the Black Ridge Road are at the Iron Post in Urbana tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock. And it's a Celestial Strings Concert with harpist Anne McLaughlin at the Starkle Planetarium at Parkland College in Champaign tomorrow night at 8:30. And on WYLL's own Prairie Performances tonight at 7 o'clock, it's a broadcast of a concert from last fall's Allerton Music Barn Festival at Allerton Park in Monticello. Their old-fashioned salute to Labor Day, featuring a band under the direction of Robert Rumbelow, also with vocalist Yvonne Gonzalez Redman. I'm Kevin Kelly for Live and Local. I'll be back with another live show Monday at 4 o'clock. Hope you'll join me for that. And this is 90.9 WYLL-FM and HD Urbana with Translator, W293 AF Danville, NPR, classical music, and more for Central Illinois. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.